a one-on-one conversation with the new mayor of Miami Beach. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Miami Beach is struggling with rising seas and a lack of affordable housing. Voters picked Dan Gelber as the new mayor, and he'll join us today to discuss those issues and more, as well as answer your questions. Peter Sagal may be most recognized as host of the NPR show Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, but he also has a successful career as a playwright. A show he wrote 20 years ago is going to be performed at the FAU Theater Lab starting this week. He'll join us today to share his stories of writing the play and his numerous other adventures. That's all coming up today on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for listening. Well, Dan Gelber easily won this month's Miami Beach election to become its new mayor. It's the second time, by the way, that Miami Beach residents have put a Gelber in office. His father, Seymour Gelber, was mayor back in the 90s. Now, he's got ideas and a style that's very different from his predecessor, Philip Levine, and he joins us now to talk about some of the bigger challenges that the city is facing and, of course, to answer your questions. So if you have a question for Mayor Gelber, please call now, 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You can also find us on Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Mayor Gelber, welcome, and congratulations, by the way.
Thanks, Luis. Thanks for having me.
All right, so you know what? When you think about, because you've already taken office, you've been sworn in, can you say that there's one big challenge that's in front of you right now that you have to face?
Well, listen, I think in a city like Miami Beach, there's a lot of different things happening. There's challenges of public safety, which are always going to happen in a city. There are challenges we have it's not unique, but it's certainly something we've led more than other areas, which has to do with climate change and sort of our efforts to create resiliency in a city that really is ground zero for sunny day flooding is the best way to describe it. We've got things that you want to do, like improve who we are as a cultural destination and how our schools perform. So I don't think there's anything that I walk in and say that's the thing we have to do, but there are a lot of things you want to do and some that you have to.
Is there one thing that you want to do first, or at least one thing that's really pressing for you?
I think one of the first things I want to do is deliver an inspector general, an office of inspector general, into City Hall. And for people that don't know, an inspector general is a watchdog. It's the way it's supposed to be and the way I'd like to see it implemented, who looks over the shoulder of the elected officials like me and the city officials who are professionals, and make sure that fraud isn't happening, that waste isn't happening, and that abuse isn't happening. And for the county has a pretty substantial office of inspector general. None of the municipalities in Dade County do, and I'd like to see one in Miami Beach because I think that would elevate how we operate, and it would give greater assurances to our citizens and our residents that we're not wasting their money or abusing it.
Have you discussed this already with the commission? How do they feel about that?
I think every one of the commissioners supports it. Many of them talked about it in their elections. Many of them have talked about it publicly. So I think not only do they support it, and it's really not even my idea, it's something that's percolated in many municipalities, but I think there's absolutely political will to do it. And I also think that our professional staff, our city manager, for instance, Jimmy Morales, happened to have been a county commissioner when the ordinance was created in Dade County. So they embrace it as well. And I'm very proud of that. The fact that a lot of places don't do inspector generals because the officials don't want someone looking over their shoulder. What could happen other than embarrassment? But our folks, my colleagues and the professional staff, they want to see it because they realize it's a good thing for good governance.
Would an inspector general have caught the banking snafu that happened where a few million dollars went missing from the city's bank account? Do you think the inspector general would have caught that?
Well, I'd like to think that an inspector general is supposed to make sure best practices are implemented. And if you look at the county inspector general reports, you'll see that in areas of procurement, financial management, and things like that, they're constantly trying to challenge the way the county does things to elevate the way the county operates. So it's a very good thing for the county. I can't assure you that that would have happened, but obviously it's exactly and precisely the kind of thing that an inspector general is supposed to address.
And you may have said this. I didn't hear, though. This person would work separately from you, from your office, from the commission, overlooking
Correct.
Basically all of you.
An inspector general is not supposed to report to the city manager or the mayor and the commission, because then it's not, you can't say that person is independent. You have to give them a measure of independence, a great measure, so that there's no political repercussion for them if they announce something that may be politically embarrassing. What happens in a mature government is that people embrace that kind of oversight. And in fact, we have an example of it in Dade County. The school system, Dr. Carvalho, he wanted to have an inspector general overlooking the county. So he did an agreement with the county IG to be the IG for the school system. And they come up with reports about best practices and better management. And he implements them in a way that I think is pretty consistent with good governance. So it's not something that's that there's no precedent for.
How long do you think it'll take to put that person in position?
I hope months.
Okay. All right.
Or weeks, but not years.
Talking again with Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber, and he just was sworn into office really barely within the last couple of weeks, talking about some of the challenges that he's got on his plate. But also, we want to hear from you if you live in Miami Beach. What are some of the bigger questions that you have for him? What are some of the things that you want him to take on now that he's the mayor? 800-743-9576. That's 800-743-9576. You know what? As I mentioned, everybody knows. I mean, your father was mayor of Miami Beach. And look, you've been in the state legislature. You know, you were a federal prosecutor. So, I mean, look, this isn't new for you. But did you learn anything from your dad watching him when he was running the office? And granted, it was a very different time.
What didn't I learn from my dad and
okay.
my mom?
Okay, well, there you go.
I mean, look, the truth is I got into public service because of my parents. I'm not ashamed of it. I'm proud of it. My father really was a mayor after he had been a judge and a prosecutor, as I had been. And my mother was a career public school teacher. And my parents were wonderful examples of public service in every single way. The juvenile courthouse is named after my dad and Judge Gladstone because I think my dad was and is, because he's 98 and still around, a very honorable, ethical guy. And he has taught me so many lessons. I could spend way more than this entire show talking about them. But one of the ones I think he saw in Miami Beach. Miami Beach is a city where there's a lot happening. And my dad said when he was mayor that the most important things he would do, he would never get credit for while he was in office. He said, you just have to accept the fact that you've got to think long term and don't try to do something that's going to help you in an election cycle. Do something that's going to help your kids, maybe even when you're not even around anymore. And I think that that kind of long-term approach is very important in municipal government, especially in a city like Miami Beach, which has such a history. I was born there, so I've been there 57 years, and I have a long view backwards. I think what my dad was preaching was it's great to have a long view backwards. You have to have a long view forward. And I think that's sort of the trick to make sure that you're not worried about offending some group because it might affect your reelection. When you really should be thinking about something generationally.
And having lived there for so long, I'm curious about your views of where Miami Beach is going. You've had the chance to see the city change dramatically over the decades.
More than once.
Yes.
The city is an organic place. You know, the Dos Equis commercial, the most interesting man in the world. I think Miami Beach is the most interesting city in the world.
Interesting comparison. Okay.
And the reason is that it has all these interesting elements. It's not like any town USA. People come here to do things. So there's a lot of virtue to that, but there are also challenges to it, too. Because when you go from 85 or 90,000 of population to 200,000 or 300,000 in a given weekend, it's going to be challenging. So our virtues often are our challenges. But if I had to say what I hope we become, is I've watched Miami Beach develop an arts and cultural profile that it never had really before. It had some of it, but it didn't have what it has now. It didn't have the New World Symphony. It didn't have Collins Park. It didn't have hotels like the Sagamore and the W and Faena, which are all talking about cultural things. It didn't have residents who were so willing to invest themselves and their resources into culture. We didn't have the Arts Center, and the Science Museum, around the corner from us. So we had this critical mass of arts and culture. So for me, if I had to say what I'd like us to become in a positive way, I'd like our city and our little area here, including Miami, to become truly an international cultural and arts destination. I think that offers a wonderful type of tourist. And equally importantly, it gives our residents elements to which they can avail themselves. So it's not just great for visitors, but it's also great for the people that live there, that they have these cultural attractions around them. And anyone who goes to New York knows, you're going to go see a play, but you're going to see a lot of New Yorkers at the play and at the theater. And I think those are good, healthy, clean ways to grow tourism without really impeding your residents' quality of life.
And of course, talking about having that culture, Art Basel is around the corner.
Right.
Again, talking with Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber, we'd like to hear your thoughts, your questions, 800-743-9576. Let's go to the phones. I've got John in Miami Beach, and he's got a question about Ocean Drive. John, welcome to the program.
Yeah, hi. Good afternoon. Hello, Mayor. Congratulations for winning. I voted for you, and I had a quick question. I've been living on Miami Beach since 1968, and I was curious about what would you do, since you're the mayor, about the crime on Miami Beach, like on Ocean Drive and Washington Avenue, where you have individuals like lurkers that seem to get out of the court system and then just keep coming back to Loomis Park and just hanging out there all day drinking and doing illegal stuff on the beach. And also the homeless problem, too.
All right, so crime on Ocean Drive and the homeless problem. John, thank you so much for the call. Mayor?
And that's a good question, John. And it's not just as simply about crime. It's about code enforcement, noise ordinances. It's about the kind of establishments we have there. So, and I do think it's a multifaceted issue. And I don't like the way Ocean Drive is right now. I actually lived on Ocean Drive when I was a federal prosecutor. I actually had a right above what was then OG's at 820 Ocean Drive. I had an upstairs apartment. And it was very busy. I was right next to the News Cafe, and people would come and buzz me down on a Friday night and say, hey, let's go have a drink or go to a restaurant. And it was busy, but it was totally available to our residents because it was both safe and had a level of sort of proprietor that was attractive and sort of easy to embrace. It's really not like that now. There are still parts of that. If you go up to the Betsy, a little north of that part of Ocean Drive, you see that there are proprietors really doing great things, but too much of it has become a place where there's a little too much churn and burn. It's too raucous. There is crime. The police are doing a very good job within the atmosphere that's been created, but we have to address the atmosphere.
So interesting to bring this up. We're going to take a break, come back, take some more calls, but I want to ask you about that because obviously when you got elected, voters also decided that they would not change the time on last call. That was a big debate on Miami Beach, and I don't know if that's leading to any of these problems. Some people believe so. But again, talking with Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber, the number again, 800-743-9576. We'll come back, take some of your calls, and continue our conversation here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. In studio with me is Miami Beach Mayor Dan Gelber, who easily won the election earlier this month. And we're talking about some of the challenges that he's going to be facing as mayor. But we also want to hear from you. What are your thoughts, your questions for the mayor? 800-743-9576. Before I jump back to the phones, though, I did want to ask you, because
sure,
you were talking about you lived there on that stretch
right
of South Beach. So, but you've seen it change. You saw how this past election, voters decided no on the last call, moving the last call up to 2 a.m., leave it at 5. There were people who felt that the last mayor, felt that was causing a problem, that it could have been leading to extra crime, that there was an issue there. That's why they were even thinking about it. But your take on really that strip of South Beach, this famous strip that, is what really sells to tourists, do you like it the way it is?
No, I don't.
So what do we have to do?
Well, first of all, with regard to the last referendum on the 2 a.m. last call, I don't think the voters said we like Ocean Drive as it is. I think I happen to have believed that a referendum was a horrible way to try to address this issue. The commission should decide, because it may be that last call we address bad operators and not everybody else. That was a fairly brittle remedy that only affected a half a dozen establishments. I mean, it could be part of a solution, and it may be, but it may be we decide to increase, we get rid of parking, or maybe we go one way. Maybe we expand the side of the sidewalk. Maybe we start enforcing ordinances. Maybe we make owners and not just lessees responsible for code violations. So a lot of things to be done. Maybe increasing the police presence as well as the off-duty presence. There's so much, there's so many pieces to it. And I don't think it's going to be that difficult. And I know we're going to do it because Ocean Drive in its current state is unacceptable. There are some good operators there, but there are also some operators who are not great. And they need to know that either they're going to shape up or we're going to get them off the road. I don't want to sound like the father in the movie Footloose. Okay.
I love your references. Thank you. Okay.
But, look, I have two teenage daughters, so part of me would like to be like the father.
Do you want to stop dancing? Is that what you're
saying?
Well,
not at all the places.
Okay.
But the point is, though, we can't accept it that way. And I'm not going to balance public safety with anything. I mean, it's just, to me, it's either going to be safe and embracing of anybody, including our residents, or we're going to take dramatic action. And we'll take as much dramatic action as we want because we're simply not going to allow the current incarnation of Ocean Drive to continue. I think there are places that are trying to fix it. Even members of the Ocean Drive community are. But there needs to be some city oversight.
A conversation we're going to keep having throughout your administration. All right, let's go back to the phones. And I'm going to bring in Jeff. Jeff, welcome to the program. Jeff, are you there?
Yes.
Go ahead, Jeff.
I live in the Fort Lauderdale area, and I find that when with a friend we talk about going down to Miami, one of the greatest deterrents is the amount of traffic flowing into the city and also the tremendous difficulty of finding available and affordable parking once you're in Miami. It's a major, major deterrent and turnoff. It's very, very difficult to find parking in the city. You know, you mentioned some of the nice hotels, et cetera. The problem is when you go into a hotel to park, there's a tremendous cost associated with parking in the Fontainebleau or some of these places, $30, $35. So, you know, one of the things to make Miami more attractive for people is to make it more accessible and more affordable. And right now it really doesn't offer people that.
All right, so we're talking about parking issues in Miami Beach. Jeff, thanks so much for the call. Parking, traffic, a problem? How do you approach this?
Well, look, your virtues are sometimes your challenges. Everybody wants to come to Miami Beach. That's great, except not everybody can come to Miami Beach, and the capacity issues are challenging. There are limits. We can't start telling hotels what to charge for their valets. We can control our own parking, and we have, and we're trying constantly to evaluate how much more public parking is there. And it is moderately priced, by the way. The public parking, at least, is. And as we build town center areas, more parking opportunities exist. Like, for instance, if you go to Sunset Harbor, which has sort of only really become a town center area in the last 5 or 6 years, it's not that hard to find parking there. There's a pretty big garage, or street parking, wonderful restaurants and things like that. North Beach, there you can find parking in North Beach. But when you want to go to that entertainment district on Ocean Drive and you want to go to parts of Collins Avenue, it is going to be difficult in high peak times. And so sometimes, you know, you might consider Ubering or some public transportation, but we can't guarantee everybody's going to find a cheap parking spot when they come to it. Just like the Gables won't do that.
Do you think there are enough options when it comes to public transportation?
No, there are not clearly for mass transit. Certainly for typical mass transit, as in going to work and coming home, we don't have really any options. The bus system is addresses it. We have just put online a really wonderful trolley system. It's free, by the way. And it goes, I think the South Circuit just went online. They're good-looking vehicles. They're enjoyable. Everybody's very friendly inside of them, and they take you around the beach. So one of the options for the caller could be to come to the beach somewhere where it's not at all and jump on our trolleys. They're sort of a fun way to enjoy the beach, and they come around pretty regularly, and you can jump on and off them. I don't know if we're quite like San Francisco yet in terms of the trolleys, but it's getting there. And I, by the way, and it's something that I think we visualize as our future. We're trying to move people around, and as we get other areas of the beach, like North Beach and Mid Beach, a little bit more interesting, maybe you won't get as many beach residents going south as they'll be staying in the little town centers close to their community.
All right, before we go back to the phones, I wanted to get to this. Obviously, one of the other big issues on Miami Beach is the issue of sea level rise. Mm. The city is already working on its pumping system. And I'd read that you want to bring outside consultants in to take a look at the system as it is and what the city's planning to see if that's the most viable. So help us understand what your plans are. What are you saying with that?
First of all, I commend Mayor Levine and the commission for doing what they've done. They've a lot of other folks would have kicked the can down the road and left it for their successors, because we're spending almost $500 million. We're changing our system from a gravitational system to a pumped system. We're raising about 60 miles of roads, which creates huge dislocation, and it's a lot of taxpayer money. So the point is, though, that it's a big deal what we're doing. My view is that when you do something like that, and I think it has to be done, you want to make sure you're doing it the right way. So you don't just want to get it done; you want to get it done right. And if you can tell anything from the last few minutes of talking with me, I'm not afraid to challenge government and stop it from groupthink and challenge its assumptions. So the way to do that when you're an elected official who doesn't have an expertise in a subspecialty, who's not an engineer, although we do have an engineer on the commission, but most of us are not. I'm a lawyer. So, how do you challenge what a group of experts are telling you to do? Well, you find what I call, and what's called in sort of government, a red team, which is a group of experts whose job is to challenge what you're doing to make sure you're doing it correctly. Maybe they'll tell us we're doing the best thing we can do, or maybe they'll say your schedule's off, or maybe they'll say you ought to consider this. But the point is, when you raise 60 miles of street and you spend at least $500 million, you want to make sure you have second-guessed yourself appropriately. And I'm not afraid to do that, even if it embarrasses us a little bit, because in 20 years, I don't want to be the former mayor who didn't ask the question about whether this kind of pump is the right one to put in or that one would be better. I want somebody to help me. And there are groups that do this.
And what have you heard from the commission on that?
I think, I got to tell you, I'm very proud of my commissioners. They all, no one has said, oh, no, we're worried about the embarrassment. They all have said, I want to get it right. And most of them were on the previous commission. So they're not worried about a political embarrassment. They want to make sure that if we're telling a certain area of our city, we're raising your streets, that we're telling them we're going to do it the right height and at the right time and with the right equipment. And if there's something to be changed about that, I want to know it now, because it's very hard to undo this later.
All right, real quickly, let me get a couple of these calls in. I've got Charlotte in Miami Beach. Charlotte, thank you for holding.
Hi.
Go ahead, Charlotte.
Hi, Mayor. I wanted to know what you are planning in terms of mental health care in Miami Beach, the fact that Florida ranks so low compared to other states on per capita funding for the mentally ill, and that there is a big homeless problem as well. Do you have any agenda items in terms of making that a priority?
All right, Charlotte, thank you so much for the call and the question. Mayor.
It's a great question and a very challenging problem. I'm very friendly with Judge Steve Lifeman, who's a local judge who's really gained national prominence for how he's dealing with the homeless. And I've been on his tours. I've gone up to the top of the jail in Miami-Dade, where he points out that the largest mental health center in Florida is the Dade County Jail on any given day. And this is not a problem, by the way, that's addressed by a single city or even a state, which does horribly address this issue, frankly. So for me, I think as a city, what you've got to do is figure out what tools you have and what you can augment. I think the Homeless Trust does a pretty good job, but we have to work with them more. I think the mentally, we have actually a group on Miami Beach that works with the mentally ill from City Hall. and they do a wonderful job, but maybe they need more help. I know the Homeless Trust is trying to get us to look at whether we'll increase funding countywide for what their efforts, and I'm not sure whether that makes sense or not, but I need to come to that judgment along with my fellow commissioners, because homelessness is not an easy issue to deal with, and it's not one that ever goes away. And Miami Beach, as I said, everybody likes to come to Miami Beach. Well, homeless people like to come to Miami Beach because of our beaches and our weather and the food in our restaurants that is often discarded. There's a lot of attractiveness to that. But we've got to figure out how to humanely deal with it so that they're not endangering themselves or others. And it's not a simple city issue. It's because they've got to go somewhere. And we certainly can't provide all the care necessary to take somebody to transition them from homelessness to operationally, you know, having a job and not being homeless. It's not something a single city and certainly one our size could do alone.
So this leads really to my last question for you is because that in part is also a state issue and what the state could do to help cities. You were in the legislature as the session's about to begin. You know, what are you hoping from this? Okay, all right. So I'm looking at you. So you nod your head.
My head negatively.
Okay. So you know what? The session's going to begin in January. What are you hoping is going to come out of the session that's going to be beneficial to South Florida, beneficial to Miami Beach?
Well, I hope they'll look at some of the resiliency issues. We're spending a lot of our money on this, and we're not getting a whole lot of help elsewhere. So I hope they look at some of the resiliency issues. And Governor Scott and the legislature, I think we've crossed the Rubicon that the sea level is rising because we have sunny day flooding in our city, as many cities in Florida are getting increasingly. So I hope that they deal with resiliency. I hope they fund more mental health issues, because a lot of that is money that they either are supposed to spend and won't, or simply just don't because they want to show how austere they're being. Of course, at the expense of local government having to spend more money to deal with the repercussions of a failure to prevent things from happening. So I hope that they address these social service safety net issues, because those are the things that the city has to clean up when the legislature avoids it. I also hope that, because I think this is significant to everyone but us as well, school funding. We have a feeder pattern that's only, you know, less than a dozen schools out of, I think, 380 in Dade County. But I'd like to work to elevate our feeder pattern, as I know a lot of other mayors and others want to in their communities. And I feel like the legislature has to really reverse the trajectory of underfunding public education, because while it's not a traditional city role, it's going to be something we're going to delve into substantially when I'm mayor. And it's one that I think defines your community and who you have living next to you.
All right. We'll have you back to discuss when the legislative session gets underway. And we didn't even get to a lot of the topics that I'd hoped to today. But Mayor Dan Gelber, it's been a pleasure. Thanks. You so much.
Thank you, Lewis.
And again, if you have any comments or questions for the mayor, you can always find us on Twitter, @WLRNSundial. All right. Coming up next, a conversation with NPR host Peter Sagal from Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me and his new play coming to South Florida. It's all next on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Frank and Doris are a retired couple who decide to take their granddaughter and make a run for it. And where do they go? Well, of course, here, Florida. That's the premise of a new show at the FAU Theater Lab. It's called Most Wanted. It's a show that was written more than 20 years ago by Peter Sagal. Yes, that Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. The show runs from November 30th through December 14th. And he's joining us now from WBEZ in Chicago. Peter Sagal, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you. But from now on, I think I want to be introduced whenever I appear as that Peter Sagal.
That Peter Sagal.
Yes, it's that Peter Sagal. Well, whatever implications you intend.
Well, you know, if you Google Peter Sagal, you do get a few different people. You're not
really?
The only one, yes.
I didn't know that. For a while, there was like a guy who sold fabric of some kind in Jersey City. Well, but other than that, I thought I was the only one.
Well, it all comes down to the spelling of the name, of course.
I guess so, yes. So,
well, thank you so much for taking the time to be with us today. You know, talking about your play, I mean, I want to get to all of your adventures, because you have lived an adventurous life up to this point. Your play, Most Wanted, is partly set here in South Florida.
In fact, it's, well, yes.
Most of
it,
right?
Entirely set in Florida.
Okay.
Yes. I know you guys are very sensitive about this, so only like 90% of it is in South Florida.
Okay. How well do you know South Florida?
I know it fairly well, I guess as well as someone who has neither really lived there or have close family members who live in your neighborhood. But keep in mind, I'm a middle-aged Jew. I have a natural affinity for your area. It's like my ancestral homeland in a weird way. When I dream, I dream of Boca Raton. I've been to South Florida many, many times, including, and this is key to this particular story, a bunch of times back in the 90s when a wonderful theater called Florida Stage in Manalapan did a few of my plays under the artistic directorship of Lou Terrell. And that's why this play is happening now at FAU, because Lou, who ran Florida Stage until its sad demise about 6 or 7 years ago, has started the theater program at FAU. He's built it up from just a reading series to now a producing organization. And he asked me, do I have any plays set in Florida? And I said, why, yes, I do. It's been sitting around for a while, and so now it will be birthed to the world after a very long gestation.
You know, I mean, obviously writing about Florida, and I wondered as you were writing it, were there any cliches that you were worried about falling into?
Oh, there were cliches that I embraced. I mean, because keep in mind, I mean, the Florida that I depict in this play is not the real Florida. In fact, one of the things I wanted to make sure of is that at no point, with one exception at the end of the play, are we ever specific about where we are, right? So there are no scenes set, for example, in Miami or in Jupiter or in Palm Beach or, for that matter, in Tampa or Sarasota, although all of those places I have been, and that conveyed my understanding of what Florida is. This is kind of like the mythical Florida. This is – imagine someone who has never really been to Florida but imagines certain things about it. And that's the Florida that these people end up in. It's not, shall we say, a realistic play. So it's more about the idea of Florida. Florida is a place where you go to both to reinvent yourself, as a place you go to at the end of your life, as a place that you go to escape whatever it is that you're leaving behind. That's the Florida that this play takes place in, not the actual one that you were just discussing with the mayor.
That Florida, yes.
That Florida.
That's how I do everything now. It's just that
Florida. That Florida. Oh, that Florida.
That,
oh, that Peter Sagal talking about that Florida.
Pretty
well,
much.
Now we know.
Pretty
yeah,
much,
pretty
exactly.
Much.
This yeah. It's a comedy, but it deals with a lot of serious themes. And you have this conflict between parents and grandparents. And I'm wondering, you know, did you have personal experiences that inspired this?
Yes and no, in the sense that it was inspired by something that was happening in my family, but not to me directly. This all started more than 20 years ago. When my brother, older, had a child with his wife, the first grandchild in my family, and my parents were very excited, and wanted to come see the child. It was just one child at the time, all the time, and more so than my brother and sister-in-law would have preferred, and so it caused some tension. I'm sure some of your listeners might be familiar with this. And, you know, in real life, nothing happened except everybody accommodated each other. And now that young baby has grown up and she's now teaching classics at a high school in the Bay Area. She's engaged to be married. She's a lovely young woman. But anybody who's ever done any kind of creative art, be it painting or novel writing or playwriting, knows that a lot of things start with just asking yourself, well, what if? You know, and in my case, I asked myself, what if people like my parents, not my parents, in a similar situation, we're just grab the kid and go. What would happen? And that led to this play. And then, of course, what the play ended up being about ended up surprising me back then. And hopefully will surprise people now who get to see it.
You wrote this. I mean, as you mentioned, it was written quite a while ago. And
it was.
I wonder, have your ideas about parenting changed since then?
Oh, Lord, yes. although, weirdly, this is very strange to see something that I had written when I was a much younger man, a 20-year younger man, and to see me, or I guess hear me, writing about things that I thought I understood and didn't understand in the way that a lot of young people don't, but think they do. And it was fascinating. And in fact, I had this instinct. I was like, oh, well, you know, geez, I was so – my perspective on this or that, mostly having to do with children and having parents, has changed. And I actually thought when I first saw the play redone as a staged reading earlier this year, I thought, well, I should really just completely rewrite it and change everything and reflect my much more mature perspective, especially the perspective of having children myself. But no. I mean, the guy who wrote this play, even though he was me, deserves a little bit of respect, including when he was wrong. And so I more or less left it as it was or is. I did cut it a little because young people tend to go on, and I'm no longer patient with that. But what's really weird to me is how much the author, that younger me, was interested in the experience of these elderly people. And what's weird is I'm much closer to the age of the characters now than I was to the age I was when I wrote it, right? These elderly people. I'm only 10 or 15 years away from where they are, and I'm 20 years away from was when I wrote it. So I what I find is that I wrote about these older people from a younger perspective with more sympathy than I would have thought I was capable of, if you can follow along.
It's interesting.
There's a lot of time shifting here. I know. It's very strange.
Yeah. Well, we'll work it out.
There's old me, current me. Anyway, go on.
No, but I find interesting is like when you're talking about the younger you,
yes,
is like another person. Is that
yes.
Is it another person? Like, you're so different. You're not that guy.
That's a real question, you know? I mean, it's like, am I a different person? Certainly my perspective on things was very different. Certainly I haven't had a lot of experiences that I hadn't had. The verb tense gets complicated. At that time, I had not had a lot of experiences, which I have had now. And had I had those experiences, I probably would have had different opinions back then, more fitting the ones I do now. But because I hadn't had those experiences, I couldn't have had those opinions. So why even bother? Following along, everybody?
That sounds like right out of the Matrix movie.
It really does. It just just blows your mind, right? And so it's very interesting to me. And like, it's like, is it a different person? Well, I think you were probably a different person in some ways 20 years ago, and you'll be a different person 20 years from now. And that to me, I mean, so in a weird way, when I'm watching the play, I have the same relationship to the author as all of you might have. Like, who is this guy? What does he have to say? What does he think? What's going on? What are his opinions? What's his perspective? What are his ideas? And some of them I was very proud of. Some of them I was not so proud of. And some of them I was happily surprised by, if you can imagine that.
Do you think you would get along with the younger version of yourself?
I would probably find him absolutely insufferable. I would probably say, listen, you think you know a lot about X or Y. You have no idea what's coming, or your opinion about that. You know what I would probably say if I had like 30 seconds with the 30-year-old man who wrote that play? I would probably look at him and then say, don't be so sure.
I think we all might have that same feeling about our younger selves. Yeah,
I probably would also say relax a little bit. But you know, one of the great things about the play is that it's about a lot of things. It's about having parents. It's about having children. It's about time. It's about running out of time. It's even to a certain extent about death. And you know, the wonderful thing about being young is that you honestly believe you have something important to say about that. So I don't know if I would have had the courage to tackle those topics, certainly in a comic and somewhat strange way, were I to sit down now. I think I'm much more humble. And there's something to be said for the arrogance of youth. We owe a lot to it.
I'll think about that when I think about my younger self. But again, I'm talking with Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. His play, Most Wanted, is playing. It starts November 30th. It runs through December 17th at the FAU Theater Lab. We'll have more information, by the way, on our website. We're going to continue this conversation with Peter Sagal in just a moment here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez, and I'm joined by Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. Again, as I mentioned, his play, Most Wanted, is going to be performed at the FAU Theater Lab, and that runs November 30th through December 17th. We'll have more information on our website. You know, Peter, I didn't realize this. I had to look it up, and then it hit me like, whoa, Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me is going to be 20 years old in January, right?
I know.
20
Isn't
years.
Isn't that crazy?
Okay, so I don't know if it's a fair question, but you've had so many, like, amazing guests. You've traveled the country. Is it fair to say, like, can I ask, Is there one show or one guest that stands out, or do you just have to look at the whole 20 years and kind of make sense of the whole, you know,
It's far more like that, because the 20 years have been filled with such remarkable experiences, most of which I never thought I would have. For example, selling out the Arsht Center a couple times back in, I think it was 08, the last time we were in Miami, but also playing Red Rocks in Denver and Carnegie Hall in New York and Tanglewood in Massachusetts and Wolf Trap and the Civic War Memorial Opera House. And, you know, playing these enormous theaters to very enthusiastic crowds when, you know, I'm just this smart-ass Jewish guy from New Jersey. I never expected that I would ever have the, you know, and in a weird way that's particularly surprising, because as should be clear from your entire context of the conversation, I used to be a playwright. And the thing about being a playwright is nobody sees you. I had reconciled myself that the role I should take would be the guy in the back that people just notice when they wonder why that guy is pacing back and forth tearing out his hair. And instead, you know, I get to perform in front of all these people with amazing colleagues and friends and guests, and that has been extraordinarily exciting. And that, you know, because of the reach of the radio show, I have this wonderful community of public radio listeners that greet me happily wherever I go. This doesn't suck. Can I say suck? I guess you can say suck.
Well, you already did.
Yeah, I already did. Suck, suck, suck. I said it some more. So, yeah, but there have been, you know, just like so many strange and wonderful things. I've interviewed two presidents, Barack Obama and Bill Clinton, one before he was president, one he was after. I've interviewed some of the heroes of my youth, like Leonard Nimoy, who played Mr. Spock, and Carrie Fisher, who played Princess Leia, and Carol Burnett, who I used to watch with my grandmother and thought was the funniest thing in the world, and she told me she thought I was funny. Can you imagine that? That actually happened. You know, I got Al Gore to giggle. These are not small things. And as well as just, you know, having the pleasure of doing this show every week and having people consistently come up to me and say to me how much pleasure and relief, in a way, they get from the show. I mean, it's really... it's kind of this ongoing privilege that I never thought I would deserve. So
I think it's
kind of hard to boil it down into one thing, to tell you the truth.
I think it's fair to say, like a lot of people, that we would love to be the fly in the room in the writer's room. What's that like?
Well, I mean, if anybody has ever been as part of a writer's room, and that could be anything from working on a TV show or any other creative project, be it an ad campaign or whatever it may be, you know that one of the rules is that if you're going to come up with something good, you can't censor any of the ideas. And then, of course, you get what, you know, as they say, you put it up on the wall and you see who salutes or whatever the phrase is. But so one of the things people should understand is our writer's room, our editorial meetings, is the filthiest, most horrible kind of stuff you can possibly imagine. And we crack each other up and we're all weeping with laughter at the insanely filthy, horrible, incredibly tasteless thing that somebody just said about somebody prominent and more important than we are. And then we all kind of laugh and giggle and catch our breath and say, okay, what are we really going to say? So it's a lot of fun. I mean, we have the pleasure that I don't think a lot of other people get to in this life, which is that the entire purpose of our jobs is to have a good time. Because one of the things that we have said, one of the things that we always say to everybody is that basically our show is enjoyable to the audience exactly to the extent that it is enjoyable to us. If we have a good time. This is what I say to guests, people who are going to be on our show. I call them up and I talk them through the show and I say, the most important thing is the more fun we have, the more fun our audience has. So we get to devote ourselves to having a fair amount of fun, because that's basically the secret to our success.
No question. You can hear that fun, and I would love to hear some of those horrible, dirty things you guys say. But
we would be shut down faster than, you know, an illegal casino. We would be raided by the police. It would look like that scene from The Untouchables breaking down doors with axes. It would not be a healthy thing. Nobody can ever know.
You know, but having fun, do you have to be balanced in the terms of who you're poking fun at?
We, I think, have to be neutral. And what I mean by that is the problem with thinking of it as balance is you say, okay, well, if I'm raising my left hand now, you can't see me. If we're going to do something on this side of the political spectrum, well, we need to do an equal amount of the stuff on the other side. And that, I think, is a false measure, because there may not be as much stuff on one side as the other. And so in order to pursue quote-unquote balance, you might spend your time doing less enjoyable, interesting, relevant material. What we are is neutral. And what I mean by that is no matter who we're picking on, given the moment of it may be, we're never taking sides in the great political debate. I always say that the most important thing for us at Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me in regard to the political stuff we do, a lot of our stuff, of course, is just fart jokes and animals down people's pants. But in regard to that, the most important thing is that we never become part of the constant combat that sadly we are all subjected to whenever we turn on any media these days. Pretty much most media is somebody shouting at you either things you disagree with or things you agree with. And in my view, it's never a pleasure to be shouted at. So we don't see ourselves as being on the field playing the game. We see ourselves being up in the stands with everybody else, with all our listeners going, wow, look at that. Isn't that crazy? Look what that guy did. And that said, we need to go where the humor is. We need to talk about what we think is genuinely funny. And on a given day or a given week, it's not always going to be balanced between one side and the other. I mean, for example, in a week with Anthony Weiner is revealed to have been using the pseudonym Carlos Danger in order to continue sending pictures of his assets to women he did not know. Well, that's something we are going to talk about. But in a week in which Donald Trump does pretty much anything Donald Trump does, well, we're going to talk about that. And in both cases, we're never going to stop and say, well, yeah, well, we're talking about a guy, he's got a D after his name. We've got to devote as much time to a guy with an R after his name, or vice versa.
Were you intimidated when Tom Hanks, if anybody doesn't remember this, Tom Hanks filled in for you as the host?
Not only did he fill in for me and the host, he filled in for when I was in Florida. I was down in Pine Island on the other side of the state taking a little break and trying to do some writing. It was a little intimidating. You know what it was like? And I really cannot think of a better example. We've probably all had this nightmare where your place is taken. It could be in your job. It could be in your home. I.e., you come home and it turns out there's somebody else living with your wife or your husband or whatever, or like, oh, I went to work and it was crazy. So it was literally like having one of those dreams. Oh my God, I had this crazy dream where I like tuned into my radio show and it wasn't me, it was Tom Hanks. You know, Tom Hanks, the movie star, was doing my show and it was really crazy and nobody like seemed to notice I wasn't there. It was awful and I couldn't wake up because it wasn't a dream. I mean, that's what it felt, utterly surreal. And it particularly felt surreal because I've met Tom, but I wasn't around that week. By definition, I was away. So it just was this very strange thing that happened in my absence and everybody was talking about. And I was just hanging out in Pine Island and going for kayak trips and trying to write a book.
Oh, if Tom Hanks were replacing me, I would just go ahead and sit back and listen. I'd probably enjoy it.
Well, I did that too, I have to admit. I listened to it with great avidity. I was like, oh, I wonder how he's going to do.
It was definitely very interesting. I can't let you go without asking that.
By all means.
You're a big fan of Game of Thrones.
I am. Oh, let's. How much time do we have? Another hour?
Oh, I
Can
wish.
We go on?
I wish. But
oh, damn it. You should have brought this up earlier.
I know.
All right. Go. Quick. So Game of Thrones.
You've read all the books.
I have.
Twice?
More than once. I've read some of them twice. I'm not going to say how many.
And you do a podcast.
I do a podcast called Nerdette Recaps Game of Thrones with Peter Sagal. It's produced by my friends Nerdette, Greta Johnson, and Trisha Bobita here in WBEZ. We do it for every season. You can find it for the last three seasons on your podcast provider.
All right, what is it about? I mean, look, there's so many great TV shows that have come out in the last 10 years, but what is it about Game of Thrones? Why are we so it's a drug. Why?
It is. It's really good. And there are so many things to describe. I mean, the acting is great, the production design is terrific. But if you were to boil down to any one thing, well, two things. First of all, it's the extraordinary complexity of the world invented by George R. R. Martin, the author, which the showrunners David Ben Watt and Weiss successfully translated to the screen. It just feels like the real world because it's as complex as the real world. It doesn't feel like a television show, at least it didn't used to, but then we get into something else. But the real reason I think it's so compelling is because, and it has this in common with shows like The Sopranos, which I also loved, and Breaking Bad, which I also loved, is that anything can happen. And there's really something compelling about watching any kind of narrative art or reading any kind of novel about people who can do anything. It's freeing. It's scary. because, you know, as we walk around in our lives, we are constricted, probably for the good, from doing things like, having our friends assassinated. But watching a show in which people can do anything they can get away with and are subject to other people who can do anything that they can get away with, kill or be killed, to sort of make it too simplistic, is really compelling and appeals to really basic ambitions like, wow, wouldn't it be great if life were like this? And also terror. Wouldn't it be terrible if life were like
this? Well, you know, dragons,
And dragons are also cool. Daenerys is a babe. Yes, fine. Go.
You're
Nudity,
right.
We all, yeah, all
right. You're right. I should have just.
Fine.
I
you want to go there? We can go there too. Yes.
I should have started.
A lot of attractive naked people. Fine.
I should have started with this. But on that note, I do have to end it. So, Peter Sagal.
I have many more thoughts about Game of Thrones.
I do too, but Peter Sagal of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, his show, Most Wanted, is going to be at the FAU Theater Lab. It runs November 30th through December 17th. Peter, we'll do another show with just Game of Thrones, I promise.
Anytime, my friend, anytime.
Thanks so much for tuning in. Thanks for joining us. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Lewis.
And that's the program. Thank you so much for tuning in. I'm Lewis Hernandez. Have a great day.